At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. This episode is not only absolutely tragic, but it involves hundreds of families and the loss of dozens of lives. I don't mean to, you know, trauma dump on you, but this is a very famous, horrific story. One that was very difficult to cover. But it also showcases both being in the right place at the right time and the wrong place at the wrong time. It shows just how one clue or happenstance or family emergency can alter a conviction or acquittal. The following is a clip from the National Geographic documentary called Oklahoma City Bombing, One Day in America. And yes, that's what this story is about. The Oklahoma City bombing, which is one that I've gotten kind of confused at certain points because of the Unabomber and the Oklahoma City bombing, just based on my age when those happened. But I remember this being absolutely devastating. So saddle up, guys. This is going to be a hard one. Rest in peace, all of the victims, and I love y'all. All right. So let's get into it. 30 years ago, there were a couple very haunting images, more than a couple, actually, on seemingly every television screen and newspaper from coast to coast of the obliterated Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, and the lifeless body of a poor old baby in the arms of a firefighter amid the rubble. In the aftermath of the explosion, the building appeared to have been split in half. The exterior walls had been blown off, revealing multiple office floors within the structure, like the exposed rooms of a dollhouse.
Part of the building has been blown away.
We're getting reports of numerous fatalities.
Hard to believe we are looking at our own backyard.
I lay there, basically buried alive, upside down in my chair, in this rubble, waiting to die.
It was the largest act of mass murder in American history at that time.
I kept thinking, is this war?
It's not something you expect to see in real life, and not in Oklahoma.
The first lady we found, she grabbed me by the collar and said, young man, there's a daycare center on the second floor. You've got to get up there and get those babies.
It was a sunny spring morning on April 19th, 1995, when an unassuming yellow Ryder truck parked in front of the nine-story building in a handicapped parking space just below the building's daycare center, which automatically does put a lump in my throat. This is This is a hard one, guys. Because it wasn't an empty Ryder truck. It was packed with nearly 5,000 pounds of explosives, comprised of agricultural fertilizer, diesel fuel, and other chemicals, intended to kill as many people as possible. The detonation that ensued at 9:02 a.m., while only mere seconds in length, decimated dozens of cars and damaged more than 300 nearby buildings in the 48 square block area. According to FBI.gov website, 20 blocks of downtown Oklahoma City were impacted and cordoned off due to the extent of the bomb's damage. The Alfred P. Murrah Building itself was seemingly torn down the middle, leaving chunks of granite and concrete and massive debris. Honestly, So if I'm saying this not as how I normally do, it's because my good friend and great writer and journalist Kate Codman wrote this script. I do most of them, but she does them here and there, and she does a great job. But every time she writes one, I like react to it in the moment because I'm like, God, this is horrible. Like, it's like I'm reading this as if I'm hearing it for the first time, even though I know the Oklahoma City bombing, but I didn't know this extent of it. And she's done a great job. So love you, Kate. But yeah, so when I react like this, it's because I'm reading it like I'm hearing it. I didn't know it was that extensive. So I'd have been 10 in 1995. Yeah, I was born in 1985. Yeah. I remember it, but I didn't know it was that massive. I remember it being, well, we'll get into it. Sorry, guys. Love you. Anywho's with me. So the building itself was seemingly torn down the middle, which I already said, but it left chunks of granite and concrete and a massive debris field that left a wake in the blast. In total, very sad, 168 lives were taken that day. 19 of them were children that had just been dropped off at the building's daycare center. The youngest victim was just 4 months old. 6 U.S. Secret Service members were among the ones that were killed. Hundreds of more people of all ages were injured, and as many as 650 were affected. 30 children were orphaned, 219 children lost at least one parent, and 462 people were left homeless in the blast radius. Here's a clip from the Oklahoma City's Channel 9 News as the events of the day were unfolding live.
That the FBI, ATF, all the federal agencies are responding, people from all over the country, obviously first aid resources and rescue resources coming in from all over the state. The governor's activated the National Guard, the entire Department of Public Safety to help out with this huge explosion in downtown Oklahoma City. And RD, you have seen more of it than anybody. Yeah. The destruction down there.
It's amazing. That building's not that old. It's a newer building. It's one of the bigger, more modern buildings in the city. Everyone's probably familiar with it. And to see more than half of it gone, you can actually stand to the south of it and look all the way through the building. So more than half of that building is gone.
How many people did you see while you were there covering it, see coming out of the
Here's
building?
Your tape, right?
Many,
this is what
many, and not just from that building. Surrounding buildings. There's surrounding buildings that are missing their facades.
What about specifically out of that building? That's a concern for many people who are watching. Certainly people have survived this, folks. We want to make that clear.
Well, unfortunately, it took me a while to get there, 15, 20 minutes. So I don't know how many people were actually, after the blast, able to walk out. While I was there, I did not see that many people.
The FBI was made aware immediately. Hell, some of them even felt the blast from their Oklahoma City field office, located only 5 miles northeast of the bomb site, which actually measured a 3.2 on the Richter scale. The area around the site of the explosion looked like a war zone. Special agent and one of the Bureau's senior bomb technicians, Jim Norman, felt the blast from his desk at the field office, saying later in an interview that it shook everything in the office. Files fell off people's desks, where they were piled up. He said, "We looked toward downtown Oklahoma City, and you could see a tan cloud of debris rising from that area. I told my supervisor, I think a bomb detonated downtown. We need to go down there." When he arrived on the scene less than 15 minutes later, Agent Norman had to park 2 blocks from the site because of all the debris. The local news had been reporting that the blast might have been caused by a natural gas explosion, which the agent heard in his car while driving to the scene. But he never thought it was a gas explosion. His gut told him otherwise. He was a seasoned bomb tech and investigator. So as he walked toward the former front end of the building, he realized it didn't exist anymore. It was gone. Wounded people were running past him. In the thick of the smoke, as he stood before the massive pit of the building debris and tangled bodies, car alarms were going off, sirens blaring all around him, it was abundantly clear that Oklahoma City and the country would never be the same. Something beyond his comprehension at the time had just taken place. Here's a clip from an interview Agent Norman did with the FBI several years ago.
It is still the defining moment in Oklahoma City. When you try to talk about when something happened, let's see, that was before the bombing, that was after the bombing. It's a measure of time like BC and AD. And, you know, throughout the country, news stories went in different directions, and they didn't keep having that. But in Oklahoma City, they did.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Special agent in charge of the FBI Oklahoma City Division at the time, Ricks, was preparing to participate in a charity golf event near the blast site, with many of his law enforcement colleagues, as well as members of the Secret Service and the U.S. Marshals Service. He would recall in a late interview that, quote, "We were just getting ready to tee off, and all of a sudden, everyone's phone started going off. I got a call from my secretary saying that there had been some type of bombing down at the Murr Federal Building. They didn't know how bad it was." As he rushed back to Oklahoma City, one of his assistants made a comment that will be important later in this episode and in the hunt for whoever set the bomb off. It was April 19th, which years prior was the last day of the 51-day standoff at Waco between law enforcement and members of the infamous Branch Davidians cult. And if you're not sure which all of that means, we conveniently have a couple episodes on it. If you'd care to go back and listen to those, it's episodes 220, 221. But this comment immediately raised a red flag in Agent Rick's mind, thinking this was all somehow connected. Perhaps coincidentally, Or not, the date also marked the anniversary of Patriots Day, which was when Americans rebelled against British authority in Lexington, Massachusetts, in 1775. Agent Ricks was set to the task of setting a unified command with leadership between the FBI and the local fire and police departments. The group converged at the front of what remained of the Murat Building, which looked like it might collapse at any moment. By mid-afternoon, a command center was taking shape, with 190 phone lines in operational order. SWAT was on the scene, providing security. FBI photographers were flashing their cameras at potential evidence, and bomb techs looked for potential explosives and other evidence. Washington, D.C. soon had 120 special agents descending on the chaotic scene. Witnesses were interviewed at the height of their shock and confusion about what they just experienced. Standing in the midst of the debris, the wounded, the dead, and billowing dust and smoke, Agent Ricks could feel the crushing weight of the task ahead. He said at the time, quote, "I think we all understand the enormity of what it was. To keep your sanity, the best thing you could do was to jump in and work as hard as you could to try and get this thing solved." Special Agent Bomb Tech Barry Black was at Tinker Air Force Base that morning, 7 miles from the blast, when he heard the thunderous boom and turned his head toward downtown. He said later in an interview that the explosion was loud enough where you could see the people outside hunker down because of the noise. There was a big cloud of smoke already blowing to the north. We had no idea what had happened. He drove to the blast site to help determine the cause, and upon seeing the aftermath, he immediately thought of his wife, Kelly, a federal employee who worked in the building. She was able to contact Agent Black on his pager sometime later, saying that she was okay, but she had just barely escaped with her life. A mere 2 minutes before the blast, she and two colleagues found their way out of the parking garage and had even driven their vehicle in front of the Ryder truck on their way to the highway. That was 2 minutes, a mere matter life or death, though they didn't know it at the time. They literally passed the truck. Florence Rogers was another federal building employee at the credit union on the building's third floor, who also barely escaped with her life. She was seated at her desk that morning in a meeting with 8 other credit union employees when suddenly she found herself thrown backward onto the floor. Her desk had landed on top of her, along with other office items. When the dust cleared, she realized she couldn't see her colleagues. There was an eerie silence in the immediate aftermath before she realized that her office floor had become an open pit and she could see daylight where walls and ceilings should have been. That's so creepy, so eerie. I can't even imagine that. And then there's Aaron Alman, who did not work at the building but lived nearby and had enrolled her daughter, Bailey, at the building's America's Kids Daycare. The day the bombing happened, her daughter had celebrated her first birthday. She had dropped her daughter off that morning and traveled 6 miles to work, and like others throughout the city, had felt the blast from miles away. It felt like thunder, but the sky was blue. She wondered if it could have been a demolition of a building downtown. Erin heard from her coworkers that there had been an explosion, and when she saw the footage on the television in the break room, she saw the building where she had just dropped her daughter off. Or should I say, what was left of the building? And I'm sure she realized what she was looking at. The space that she had just said goodbye to her child. I can't imagine what she was feeling. It's so painful. Erin immediately drove with a colleague and got as close to the scene as she could. It was chaos. She told the BBC in an interview that, I remember walking to the front of the building and seeing everybody walk around with blood everywhere. I was surprised anybody came out of there alive. After not being able to get answers on the scene, Erin searched for her daughter at a nearby hospital. Her daughter would be found in the rubble and handed to firefighter Chris Fields. He cleared her throat, which was blocked with debris, and tried to open her airway. She had also suffered from head trauma, and there was no sign of life. He carried her tiny, lifeless body to an ambulance in the hopes of finding a blanket to cover her with, but the vehicle was already full. And that was when photographers captured the moment that would become the most famous image of that day. Innocence, cruelty, horror, and tragedy all encapsulated in one image. Meanwhile, Bailey's mother was still bouncing around between hospitals, begging for information. She finally got answers from Bailey's pediatrician, who delivered the crushing news. Her priest was there with her. And they said, quote, I remember going home that day, thinking that the worst thing that could ever happen has happened. But then I woke up the next day and I looked for a newspaper. Every time I went to the store, that picture was on the front of the magazines. I would go to the doctor's office and there it was, on every television show, every news station, on the front of t-shirts, on coffee mugs. It was everywhere and it was devastating. The photograph of the firefighter and Bailey received a Pulitzer Prize. But according to her mother, quote, it broke my heart that she had to be seen that way. I have no rights to that picture at all. I can't say how it was used. When you die, your rights are abolished, end quote. And I will say, after looking at this photo, it's just so heartbreakingly sad. It makes me angry that Erin couldn't seem to even escape it. Like, it was always everywhere for her. But in happier news, the firefighter who tried to save Bailey's life became a close friend of the family. Here's an interview with Chris Fields and Erin that they did with ABC News 4 years ago.
You know, a mother is going to know that's their baby. That was my thinking.
That mother, 22-year-old Erin Allman.
I knew it was her right away. I recognized her right away, but I also knew those were the clothes that I put on her that morning and stuff. So, I mean, I knew it was her. In fact, when I saw the paper, I was like, that's Bailey.
Baby Bailey had just turned one the day before.
This is for Bailey's birthday, the day before she died, with all her cousins. There's a lot of them.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Those who lost loved ones had to wait years for justice. Initially, Middle Eastern terrorists were suspected in the bombing, given the first World Trade Center bombing, just 2 years prior. But that would all change with little clues left along the way, like the VIN number of the Ryder truck that was traced back to a body shop in Junction City, Kansas. Shop employees helped the FBI create a composite sketch of the man who had rented the van, and nearby hotel employees gave them a name, Timothy McVeigh. The vehicle's rental agreement verified his identity. Timothy McVeigh was an ex-Army soldier and former security guard. He was born April 23, 1968, in rural Pendleton, New York, to a blue-collar family. From an early age, he showed an interest in guns. After graduating from high school in 1986, he spent a short time at a local business college. When business classes lost their luster, he picked up a copy of the Turner Diaries, a 1978 anti-government neo-Nazi book that detailed the truck bombing of the D.C. FBI headquarters. McVeigh enlisted in the Army in 1988 and was surprisingly a model soldier. He earned a Bronze Star for bravery in the Persian Gulf War and was a candidate for the Special Forces, but dropped out after 2 days. Perhaps something that happened in those 2 days soured him in his military career. He took an early discharge in 1991, and then his paranoia began to creep in about an alleged government plot to appeal the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the right to bear arms. After returning to New York, he was unable to find steady work, as many of our veterans struggle to do, sadly. He convinced his Army buddies, Terry Nichols and Michael Fortier, to help him sell guns at gun shows throughout the country. But his paranoia toward the government was still there. In 1993, he drove to Waco, Texas, to observe the FBI siege of the Branch Davidian compound. He was appalled by what he saw and viewed the government's actions as illegal. This led to McVeigh, Nichols, and Fortier making contact with members of militia groups in the Midwest, and before too long, McVeigh began plotting his course to destroying the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, along with the help of Terry Nichols. Within 90 minutes of the bombing, a man was pulled over near the Kansas border and arrested in an ancient Mercury sedan because the rust bucket of the car had no license plate registration tags. That man was none other than the bomber himself, who rented that Ryder van. It's almost like he wanted to get caught. Or maybe he was narcissistic enough to think he would evade the police for the rest of his life, or maybe he was just panicked. How could he so meticulously plot out an attack and kill so many people and not pay attention to this one detail that would cause such a scenario to play out with Highway Patrol and ultimately lead to his arrest? Oklahoma State Trooper Charlie Hanger was working the day shift when the bomb exploded. Initially, he was ordered to the area to assist, but was almost immediately told to return and remain in his own area. If he had remained at the scene, who knows how far Timothy McVeigh would have traveled, and if he might have gotten away with it. But sometimes, you're just in the right place at the right time. Trooper Hanger passed the yellow Mercury sedan missing its license plate about 80 miles north of Oklahoma City. Something told him to slow down, to let the car get ahead of him, and once it did, Charlie hit his overhead lights and proceeded to pull the vehicle over. A strange feeling washed over him. Maybe he could feel it in his gut. Maybe it was divine intuition. But Charlie got a strange feeling about the driver. Instead of approaching the vehicle, Trooper Hanger called for the driver to step out of the vehicle and walk to the area between the two cars. Charlie asked the driver for his license, and when Timothy McVeigh reached for it, it became clear that he had a weapon underneath his jacket. The suspect admitted to having a weapon and said it was loaded. Charlie had drawn his own weapon by this point and handcuffed McVeigh. Not only was the .45 caliber Glock loaded in a quick draw suicide holster, but McVeigh also had a spare magazine and a knife hidden on his person. This led to a concealed weapons charge, and McVeigh was booked and taken to jail. It was then discovered that there were trace amounts of the chemicals used in the explosion on McVeigh's clothes. In another twist of fate, the judge that McVeigh was supposed to appear in front of was unable at the time because of a family emergency. Had this appearance taken place when it was intended to, McVeigh probably would have been released the next day or the day after that. But instead, on April 21st, 2 days after the bombing, the FBI called the Bureau's Criminal Justice Information Services Division in West Virginia and realized their suspect, John Doe number one, was already in jail. Nothing is lining up in this guy's favor. He was then taken into federal custody. Nichols turned himself into authorities shortly thereafter. I think Trooper Hanger had some good karma coming his way. During a routine search of his own squad car, Charlie found a business card that had been discarded by McVeigh when he was squirming around handcuffed in the back seat. The card was from a military surplus store in Wisconsin. And that wasn't the damning part. Written on the back of the card in McVeigh's writing were the words, "We'll need more TNT. $10 a stick." And Trooper Hanger always maintained that he was just, quote, in the right place at the right time. Here's an interview Trooper Hanger did with the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum about the events that unfolded that day in the days that followed that changed everything.
Because of routine traffic enforcement, you know, he was picked up that day just on a routine traffic stop and put in jail. Now, the other divine intervention that I was talking about is that why was he still in jail on Friday when he should have saw the judge on Thursday? Well, on Thursday, the reason he didn't see the judge is because the judge was tied up in a divorce case and he didn't have time to bring him down and arraign him. On Friday, he would have probably already had seen him that morning before we got the call inquiring about the Social Security number and which subsequently placing of a hold on McVeigh. But the judge's son missed the bus to go to a band function in Stillwater, and he had to take him over there, thus making him late for court again. I call all of that divine intervention.
It was also discovered after conducting more than 28,000 interviews and following up on some 43,000 investigative leads and nearly a billion pieces of information that a friend of McVeigh's, Terry Nichols, had helped build the bomb. Another man, Michael Fortier, was aware of the bomb plot. The investigation as a whole was one of the most exhaustive in FBI history. And even though the case was solved and convictions were made, many questions remain regarding the nuts and bolts of the case and potential other suspects. An article by The Guardian raised many of these questions, like the whereabouts or explanation for a different Ryder truck seen by multiple witnesses at McVeigh's Kansas motel, as well as the state park where the bomb was assembled leading up to the April 19th incident. Which it's crazy to me that this month it will be 30 years, you know, since that happened. And very close to when this episode comes out. So continue on. So, or the two people that were seen renting the actual bomb truck in Junction City. So let me read before that. Witnesses at McVeigh's Kansas Motel, as well as the state park where the bomb was assembled leading up to the April 19th incident, or the two people that were seen renting the actual bomb truck in Junction City, Kansas on April 17th, that didn't entirely match McVeigh's description. Their sketches were widely circulated in the days after the bombing. It doesn't seem either of those people could have been Timothy McVeigh, as he was caught on surveillance tape at McDonald's shortly before the timestamp on the rental agreement. He couldn't have made it in time. Another unanswered question, the 20 eyewitnesses that claimed to have seen McVeigh on the morning of the bombing with other people whose identities remain unknown, who were they? And then there were all of the near misses in preventing the attack in the first place. According to the article from The Guardian, it is alleged that in early 1995, post the Branch Davidians Waco siege, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the ATF, failed to inform the FBI that it had an informant inside a remote community called Elham City in eastern Oklahoma that had reported talk of potential bombings. The ATF pulled the informant out rather than acting on the informant, supposedly because they were afraid of triggering another Waco-like event. 2 weeks after the informant was taken off the beat, McVeigh telephoned the community and visited in search of recruits. The ATF director at the time, Jim McGaugh, said in a 2010 interview that the bomb plot might have been thwarted if the informant hadn't been pulled from the case. And then there was another failed attempt to put the puzzle pieces together back in 1994. A propagandist named Louis Beam, who senior ATF investigator called, quote, the most dangerous man in America, that's very scary, told career criminal Roy Beard that something big would happen in Oklahoma City, Denver, or Dallas on April 19th, 1995. Mr. Bird, not Beard, I read it wrong the first time, gave this information to the FBI. But the government failed to interview Beam for more information. How many other missed clues were there? It's so sad to think about the warning signs that were missed. That's also very eerie to think that it could have happened in your city. Like, if you're listening to this podcast, you live in Denver or Dallas, and it, like, I mean, it's absolutely awful that it happened in Oklahoma City, but just thinking, like, they were thinking about targeting a few places, and sadly, Oklahoma City was the chosen one. So the original plan for the Oklahoma City bomb, according to several sources, including the FBI informant, was to not only blow up the Mira building, but also the federal courthouse next door via a shared underground parking garage. The yellow Ryder truck was supposed to be planted in that garage, similar to the bomb that had been planted beneath the World Trade Center 2 years prior. McVeigh, of course, had carefully studied this attack. What he didn't study, though, was the height of his truck in relation to the maximum vehicle height allowed inside the parking garage. The truck simply would not fit. And if I can relish in anything right now, it's that he deserves to be called an idiot. It was too tall. So as careful and meticulous as this guy was, he failed to put license plate registration tags on his getaway vehicle, which led to his arrest, and failed to compare height allowances for his desired parking spot. Who knows how many lives were saved by that lack of oversight? But still, rest in peace for the lives he took so selfishly, so disgustingly. But still, he's an idiot. But naturally, there was a plan B. Leave the vehicle in the alley between the courthouse and an old post office building, which was the site of a bankruptcy court. No luck there either. A U.S. Marshal's truck was already parked there, dropping off a prisoner. McVeigh had to back the Ryder truck out of the alley. From 8 a.m. until detonation, the bright yellow vehicle was seen several times downtown, as well as in adjoining neighborhoods before the blast at 9:02. Just looking for the perfect place to park. So many witnesses saw him. And parking in the handicap spot directly below the daycare? It seemed that was plan C and perhaps a last-ditch effort attempted by McVeigh alone. Many have doubted over the years that the plot was dreamed up and carried out by Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols themselves. Even one of the lead prosecutors against Terry Nichols, Larry Mackey, acknowledged that his team didn't entirely believe it either, telling The Guardian, quote, "If you had said this to us, anybody in the room was 100% confident that McVeigh was alone, raise your hand," end quote. We would have all kept our hands in our laps. But back to the rust bucket of the Mercury marquee that McVeigh was caught in. It doesn't seem like that was part of any plan A, B, or C. The fact that the license plates were missing and propaganda materials were left in the front seat suggested it was meant to be kept close to the bomb site as a sort of signature for their attack. We kind of know this about serial killers. Like, they want fame. You know, some serial killers pose bodies in strange ways to, yeah, make their signature. Or after they're arrested, they do interviews. They're almost proud of their, I don't know, their horrible acts. So that theory is not out of the realm of possibility to me. But after not being able to fit in the parking garage or park in the secondary location, McVeigh left in the vehicle out of sheer desperation. And that's what law enforcement believes. Possibly. Why did he do it, though? There are more questions than answers here. Timothy McVeigh granted Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes an interview approximately 25 years ago. And I highly recommend looking this interview up on YouTube if you want to listen to the whole thing. It took more than a month for the final victim to be recovered. Some bodies weren't discovered until the unstable remains of the building were demolished on May 23, 1995. Accomplice Michael Fortier was indicted on conspiracy to transport stolen firearms, among three other counts. He was sentenced to 12 years in prison on May 27, 1998, and released on January 20, 2006. Terry Nichols was initially convicted of conspiring with McVeigh to use a weapon of mass destruction. He was acquitted on the charges of first-degree murder, but convicted on the lesser charge of involuntary manslaughter and sentenced to life in prison without parole. This just weirds me out. I know I freaked out about this earlier in the script, but he is currently serving time at a supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. Underground for like 24 hours a day with El Chapo, who everyone thinks might escape. But it's just fascinating to me because it's not that far from here and I went there. I can't get over how fascinating it is because I remember reading Terry Nichols' name when I was researching that prison. But anywho, Timothy McVeigh was indicted on August 10th, 1995 and found guilty on all counts against him on June 2nd, 1997 by the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Oklahoma. He was ultimately executed by lethal injection on June 11th, 2001, at the Federal Correctional Complex in Indiana. I don't know how to say this town, Greg. Terre Haute, Indiana. We shouldn't be. Well, I guess maybe we should be happy about it. I was like, we sound upbeat about
the
someone.
The Hunter Reunion used to be in Terre Haute.
Okay, there we go. Oh, we went there. His execution happened more quickly than most, due in part to his refusal to pursue appeals or stays of execution. He made no apologies to the surviving family members while he was led to the execution chamber. In place of a final statement, McVeigh had spent his final hours copying out the last lines of a verse by British poet Ernest Henley that stated, "I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." And that is the Oklahoma City bombing story. Heartbreaking, eerie. And I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as you can to enjoy things that are all true crime and, that make you a little sad, but they're interesting. Never stop searching for interesting things to think about. So I love you guys. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you. Until next week, I'll talk to you later. Bye.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com. Mom.